Accession number 31785, reel 3.
We had to wait because we couldn't get from Stettin, or now Szczecin, to Malmö, I guess, or Göteborg in Sweden, because there were Russian submarines in the Baltic now. So the ferry wasn't working. Therefore, we had to go to Denmark. If you go to Denmark, you had to have a transit visa through Denmark, or formal and proper. So we waited in Berlin, got bombed by the English. Nasty, nasty stuff, you know, because you couldn't. When you stick a bombs fall, you know, the usual kind of boom, 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 getting nearer or further, hopefully. I couldn't distinguish between the bombs falling and anti-aircraft guns firing from the, you know, the kind of railway, high-up railway between, what do you call them, U-Bahn, in Berlin, they have, like in New York, they have railway system up top, and they would have anti-aircraft guns. And they would be kind of firing and moving at the same time. Somehow that you never couldn't tell which was which. We got bombed there a bit, and they seemed to be having a wonderful time because they were, you know, beating the Russians at the time and so on. And we eventually got to Denmark and then to Sweden, and my father was waiting there. But then he left very shortly after that to join the Polish army in Scotland, and they turned up a 40-year-old or 42-year-old second lieutenant. Absolutely pointless exercise of patriotic fervor, so he decided to give it all up and be a painter. Well, he was a painter before, but so one of his paintings takes knives, and it's quite there.
How long were you in Sweden?
3 years, 3 years, yes. Extraordinary, yeah. I mean, it was a neutral country, and so you go to the new cinema, you know, England had them too, the kind of new cinema. There's cinemas that just showed shorts, comic cartoons, news, and there'd be newsreels from UFA, the German kind of company that did the German newsreels. With the soldiers, German soldiers always moved, let me get it right, from left to right. There was a Goebbels order that you always show German soldiers advancing to the right, something like that, or maybe the other way around, but anyway. And then you would, you know, so you would have a kind of a reportage from the British, from the Germans, and then later on from the Americans also. You know. But Sweden was extraordinary. Then we flew in a Flying Fortress during the war to Scotland to join my father. But I think I must be the only 10-year-old who have flown in a Flying Fortress in wartime.
What sort of reception did you get in Sweden?
No, fairly sympathetic. I think that the Swedes were very pro-German to start with, I think. Well, they were also kind of incomprehension on their side of what was happening, really. Oh, well, I think nobody knew what was happening, really, in the occupied country, especially in the eastern, in Poland, places like that. I was part of a Catholic scout troop where we had Germans, Italians, Poles, French. It was extraordinary how we managed to kind of troop together. But we would always compare each other's kind of armies and so on. And one of the shocks I got when I got to England in 1944 was that I tried to do that with some English friends. And I got nowhere because there was no arguing with the English at all. They were the best. And if you didn't believe it, just glance at the map. the feeling of kind of innate superiority among the English was unbearable in those years. I mean, it's one of the things that I love about being in London and living in England is that all that's kind of, well, it's not all gone yet, but the Tory party will do its best to return us to the imperial. But the thing about moving from one country to another, that the heroes of one country become the villains of the other. You know? So the noble conquistadors in Catholic Poland become the bloody Spaniards.
How did you adjust to the different pace of life in Sweden, the different culture?
I think I had a kind of nervous breakdown really as a kid. So I understand. I can't really much remember it, but I just kind of withdrew for a while. So I'm a flamenco. It's easy to, for a kid, it's easy to adjust. You just adjust, you know. You learn languages very quickly when you are 12, 13. I mean, within 2 or 3 months, you're communicating. Well, you have to, you're surrounded by Swedes, or in the case of England, I was put in a bloody boarding school, in a prep school in England, so there's absolutely no chance. I think I had 2 words of England, shut up, of English, shut up, and goodbye, I mean, when I started in the prep school. But I love Sweden, the landscape is beautiful. I mean, they're very serious people, but
Whereabouts were you?
Stockholm, near Stockholm, or in Stockholm, really, yes. Yes. It was very privileged, 3 years, really extraordinary to be in a neutral country during those times. But then it came to England, and then there was a bit of a shock, really. Although father always manages to find us nice places to stay in, and so we stayed in Hampstead, and I thought London was okay for quite a while. I didn't realize that there was another side of London. But the thing which was absolutely unforgettable was my first sight of going by underground to Piccadilly Circus, emerging up the stairs, and there was this mass of soldiery with the American MPs in white helmets, and coming out of that and just looking down Piccadilly, and there was this crowd of soldiers, dressed in, there were Sikhs in turbans, there were Polish officers with a kind of square hat, and got one around the corner. There were French sailors with pompons. That kind of vast surging crowd of soldiery from all over the world, sailors, airmen, and all really kind of bent on one thing. That was to beat Hitler. It was extraordinary. The two things that kind of, well, maybe two or three things that struck me so strongly about wartime England was in London was this mix of people, the Commonwealth. I mean, the big Australian hats and all the rest. But it was just a general mix, a fantastic mix of people. I mean, I was sitting in the underground, Northern Line. Everybody tired, grey, and so on. And then I said, everybody's looking to the left. So I looked to the left, and then at the end of the carriage is an officer of the French Spahis, the colonial forces, immaculately dressed in that kind of desert khaki, the special colour, but with a French officer's cap, but immaculately dressed, and talking to a woman dressed in the same kind of uniform. They were French WAF or whatever, she was WAF, army assistants or something, and blonde. And they were like two demigods, and the whole carriage of these grey-faced, tired people looking. I mean, like two film stars, like Clark Gable, and I don't know. And this enormous mix of people. And then the other thing, and not in London, but when I was in the prep school, was looking up at the at planes getting together for the 1,000 bomber raids. I mean, it's very difficult to convey that on film. It's a bit like, you see football or tennis on television, and you see it all, but you don't really, because you don't feel the power of it. You don't feel the power of the tennis shots or the actual speed of football play. And to see 1,000 planes in the sky, the roar of the engines coming down to you, and the sheer, the kind of the power that suddenly is up there, extraordinary feeling. And that's something films do not convey. It's gathering together, squadrons moving. Amazing. And the smell of wartime. the sweaty woolen uniforms, cigarette smoke, coal smoke. But sweaty, wet woolen uniforms.
How was it that your father managed to arrange your transport from Sweden?
Oh, weird. Well, it was 44. The Swedes knew that the Germans were finished. And talking about the 1,000 bomber raids. When 1,000 bomber raid did their business in Berlin or wherever, Stettin somewhere, they would go home. But some of them would be obviously damaged in some ways. They had two choices. They could either try to get home, right, or they could go to Sweden, which was a bit nearer. Or safer. Anyway, it appeared to be near. I think it probably wasn't really. So they would say, "Oh well, we got trouble in the rear, in the right engine, and we're going to Sweden." And in Sweden, they would land. The Swedes would give them about 2 or 3 weeks, and then quietly get them back into England, which the German fighter base in Narvik would try to stop them, but on the whole, they just flew very high and managed to get back. So by the 1944, I think there was a kind of steady stream of Allied personnel going to, flying mostly, I think, to Scotland, really, the nearest airport field. They began to have some civilians going on these converted flying fortresses, just some seats put in, my father asked for us to join him, we said right, fine, Then it took us about 3 or 4 months to actually get there, because we were going to go, but the flight beforehand was shot down by the Germans, so we all kind of stopped for a while. Then we went, and there was fog in Prestwick, so we came back, and eventually we went there. And I remember the toilet was somewhere near the rear gunner's part of the plane. Yeah. So I guess the fact that my uncle was an ambassador in Stockholm, the Polish ambassador, that kind of helped, obviously. Well, obviously. And we turned up in Scotland and caught the train to Euston.
When was it that you went to the prep school?
Prep school? Derbyshire. And Thomas went, not last year, didn't we? Went to Derbyshire. And it was stunning. Even as a kind of 13, 14 year old, I realized it was a wonderful, beautiful Peak District. And we stayed, the prep school was not far from Bakewell, and Thornbridge Hall, I think it's called. And it was built by a guy who had all his money in Krupps, and during the First World War, he would get dividends from Krupps via Switzerland. And nobody kind of thought much of it because, you know, business is business, and he had shares, and why not? You know? Anyway, he built this wonderful little kind of country home for himself there, which had was a bit like the house in, described in the Secret Garden. It had an Indian room and a China room and an African room and so on. And the school had a library which was totally dominated by the empire. And I must have been one of the last kind of generations of kids brought up on that whole Victorian or Edwardian literature of heroes of the empire. It's extraordinary. Yeah. Yes.
How did the all boys, presumably?
Yes, yes.
How were you regarded by them?
Again, I was just. I tried very hard to be part of the thing. I mean, I decided that cricket was a key to kind of success, and I became a very poor off-spin bowler. But I didn't feel there were. I mean, people were. I was just accepted as just another pole. The whole business of kind of relationship between Poles and the English have always been kind of fairly amicable, you know. I mean, the kind of the first 20, 30 years after the war, every time I mentioned I was Polish, somebody would say, and my aunt here had or my mother had this Polish boyfriend, flyer pilot or something. But they were always kind of kindly connections. Yes, I think today is the same, really. It doesn't change very much.
Were you at this stage thinking of what you do after school and after the war finished?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yes, I did. And my father and his friends were absolutely no use at all to me, because none of them appeared to work. They were painters, writers, philosophers. None of them got up at 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock to go to office, to an office. So I had no model of any kind. I remember trying to figure out how to be like one of them. But it seemed to me like, well, you just had to have some kind of a talent for writing or philosophizing or whatever. That's it. So I became a teacher, because the only thing which was familiar to me was of course school. You ask a good question, and I remember kind of absolute helplessness, this feeling that I had no idea how it is to be adult. And then I went to the army. I was called up in national service, and I did that malaise. So I knew how to be in the army. I knew how to be in a pub, in a boarding school. Then I went to college, and I think I had kind of I was institutionalized for like over 10 years. Yes, it's.
Did you arrive in Britain before the D-Day invasions?
No, D-Day was still in England. In Sweden. D-Day was in Sweden, and. We arrived here shortly before the Ardennes offensive. So the V1s were finished, but the V2s were still going on. And people were so tired. And the faces of people on the ground were just, they were so tired. And this kind of, with the V2s, this feeling of, you you felt them before you heard them, because the ground would move, and then you heard them coming down. The sound would not reach you. That's right. Yes, the sound wouldn't reach you till a split second afterwards. And there were very heavy losses in people. They were killing a hell of a lot of people when they came down. But on the other hand, it was like there's nothing, it was like finger of God. There was nothing you could do about it, they fell wherever they fell. There was no defense whatsoever. And I think lots of the kind of Polish bitterness about, letting down, being let down, vis-a-vis the Russians and so on, is based on a complete lack of understanding of the Allied position and Allied interest in the closing stages of the war. I mean, it was a total priority to get to those bloody V1 bases. Never mind, Polish Warsaw uprisings and all the rest. The forthcoming onslaught with the Japanese is going to cost us, millions of dead. The whole business of the V1s. I mean, it was a nightmare for the Allies, for the English particularly. Just to how the hell did it get? V1s were no fun at all. I think it must have been the kind of war cabinet must have been a bloody nightmare. Here we are winning the war, and bloody things are coming down and killing our people every day. And then we have Poles bitching about not being recognized or whatever. I love my Poles, of course, but.
What do you remember then of the end of the war in Europe?
Well, kind of strange. For a Pole, it was very strange for a Polish boy, because there were no Poles in the victory parade. They were stopped from taking part. It was very bitter, because the Allies were so afraid of doing anything that might upset the Russians. And they needed the Russians for the war against Japan. So they just stopped the Poles taking part. That was sad. And I think that's left an enormous scar on my cousin who fought in the 1st Armored Division, Polish 1st Armored Division through Normandy and so on. I think all these, they're a dying generation, but whatever good things and good feelings and good memories they have, that kind of moment of being stopped from taking part of the victory parade seemed absolutely the betrayal. And, well, in a way it was a lack of courage, or just, because after all, the Russians wouldn't have cared a damn, really. As a kind of spectacle, it was extraordinary. It was like some kind of Roman triumphal march, because the heroes, the people you talked about, were the generals. Everybody knew Patton, McClark, Montgomery. They were all people. You would glimpse them maybe in newsreels, of course, and so on. But here, suddenly, there they were, on the jeeps, passing by. All these, it's like film stars, the stars of the war. So the victory parade was this kind of amazing show. And that was unforgettable, suddenly seeing these people face to face, they were passing by. And so, yes, it's celebrities of the war, on show. Yes, I mean, although I must have, I do like the Russian celebrations. That film when they had Stalin standing on the right hand side of the kind of film shot, and on the left, Russian soldiers bringing out captured German standards, regimental standards, and throwing them at the feet of Stalin. You know, one lot after another, another, you know, astonishing spectacle. That's a kind of Roman triumph type of stuff. Anyway, yes. So, I mean, the end of the war. I think it's, you know, tied up with the election, too, soon after that, or the extraordinary change.
Were you or your family particularly political?
No, you can. No, I don't, Tomasz. Sorry. Are you okay, Tomasz? No. Father, really in Sweden, I think. When he got to Sweden in 1940, beginning of 40, I think he managed to get there. He tried to join the Polish Expeditionary Force in Norway. He had this idea that he would go to Finland. And I remember getting postcards from him in Finland, from Finland. And then he would kind of march along till he got to Narvik. I don't think he had the slightest idea. This mission impossible, practically. You know, I mean, it's very wild and rugged country up there, and nobody lives there. But anyway, he got to Finland, and at that point, the expeditionary force was withdrawn from Narvik, and he went back to Sweden. And I think he must have had this kind of feeling that enough's enough. I've fought in two world wars. I've done all I can. And he became totally orientated towards painting, and he many years later on, when he returned to Poland in the 60s and the 50s, my cousin remember meeting him, and she said he was quite extraordinary because everybody had interest. All these kind of artists, friends, you know, but everybody had, apart from being painters or writers, had interest to sort out, you know, the things that about your home, your car, or whatever, you know. And he said your father was one who had absolutely no other interest except to paint. He never talked about anything else, and so there was kind of a big changeover. And when he came to England, he really didn't want to fight in the war anymore. He didn't see any sense in the effort. Anyway, at 42, he couldn't be a frontline soldier. And so he devoted himself totally to painting, and he got a job at Corsham, the west of England, Academy of Art. A man called Ellis started a school there, and there were a lot of people, the kind of old generation of English painters were there. So he was very much kind of into painting, and people like Topolsky, who was always trying to make it with my sister. They were not particularly political. They were painted artists, or you know. And my mother discovered Teilhard de Chardin, you know, philosophers, and we were not, and we didn't keep, we didn't stay in touch very much with the Polish emigre society, because my mother hated the whole kind of landowning business, and I also really, very corrupting business, that kind of feudal society. And as a kid, I realized there was something absolutely wrong, the difference between my kind of surroundings and the peasant boy's surroundings. It's just morally not good.